The headlines. Iran's top security official likens a 2015 agreement to an empty shell, ruling out any talks beyond the JCPOA due to Washington's noncompliance and Europe's inaction. Protesters in Bahrain set fire to an Israeli flag to show their anger at the Israeli Prime Minister's visit. The fallout from the trucker-led Freedom Convoy deepens in Canada as Ottawa police chief resigns amid criticism over his handling of the protests. Our top story for this half hour, Secretary of Iran's National Security Council says the U.S. and Europe have failed in fulfilling their obligations regarding the 2015 Iran deal. In a tweet posted a short while ago, Ali Shamkhani said, because of such inaction, the deal has already turned into an empty shell for Iran, both in terms of the economic benefits and the removal of the sanctions. The top security official said there will be no negotiations beyond the deal. With a non-compliant Washington and a passive Europe, currently Iran and the remaining signatories are engaged in intensive talks in Vienna to revive the accord. Iran is demanding a verifiable removal of sanctions, as well as guarantees that the deal will last beyond the current U.S. administration. Advisor to Iran negotiating team, Mr. Mohammad Marandi, is joining us now from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Mr. Marandi, it's great to have you with us. Trust is the main word here, the key word here, as Iran is demanding a verifiable removal of sanctions as well as guarantees that the deal will last beyond the current U.S. administration. The question is, with all the reactions that we saw from the Republicans in the lead-up to the latest round of the negotiations in Vienna, can the U.S. be trusted in that regard at all?
No, the United States can't be trusted, nor can the Europeans be trusted, because we've seen that the Europeans do whatever the United States tells them to do, whether it's Obama, when he warns financial institutions, insurance companies, shipping companies, major investment corporations not to deal with Iran. That was a violation of the nuclear deal, and the Europeans went along with it. When Trump tore up the deal, the Europeans nagged about it, but they went along with it. Under Biden, the Europeans continue to pursue Trumpian maximum pressure sanctions. We have to keep in mind that as we speak, maximum pressure sanctions against women and children continue to be implemented both by the Europeans and the Americans. So under such circumstances, there's no reason for anyone in Iran to trust the Europeans or the Americans about their nuclear commitments, about their commitments to the nuclear deal, nor can the Iranians trust them about with regards to any other form of negotiations. When the Europeans and the Americans are seen as unreliable partners within the JCPOA, then how can other issues that go beyond the nuclear program be discussed with these countries in the hope that an agreement would be respected by the Europeans and the Americans?
All right, thanks a lot. Advisor to the Iran negotiating team in Vienna, Mr. Mohammad Marandi, joining us from the Austrian capital. Thank you for your comments. Elsewhere, the Yemeni army releases footage showcasing its advanced drone technology and capabilities. The video includes footage of drones used in the Yemeni army's latest attacks against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates. The Saudi-led coalition has in recent weeks intensified its attacks on Yemen, targeting civilian infrastructure, including telecom stations across the war-ravaged nation. The Yemeni army, in turn, has ramped up cross-border retaliatory strikes. Sana says it will continue the operations until the aggressors and the war and lift the blockade on Yemen. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti says the footage proves the allegation that the Yemeni army launches its drones from civilian areas is totally false.
This release of footage is a clear proof That shows that the Saudi and United Arab Emirates claim that those drones are launched from populated area or that they are launched from airport. So this footage shows that launching those drones is just simple. They just need three metal bars, and you can put them anywhere in rural area in Yemen, and then you can launch them very quick and very fast. There is no need for runway. And as well, we have seen that this footage was so clear that the Yemeni army has not like hide the mountains or the landscape, because if you see there is some programs, either Google Earth or Google Map, that when you see a landscape, you can from that picture of the landscape find the area that those drones were launched. And I think this is as well a clear proof that anyone can look out and find that those drones were actually launched from area across Yemen. And as well, it is proof when United Arab Emirates and Saudi always claim that they have targeted the so-called the launching site. I mean, it's just three bars. They have used as well rocks just to hold those bars and then put the drones on the top of it. So it exactly shows that it's so simple to launch these drones from any area in Yemen.
The Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Bahrain has caused a lot of outrage. They're prompting many people to turn out and make their opposition heard. The protesters marched through the streets of the capital Manama and chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and in support of Palestine. They also burnt the Israeli flag. Naftali Bennett's short trip to Manama marks the first such visit by an Israeli leader to Bahrain. Bennett met with Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa and the Prime Minister, Crown Prince Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa. The Israeli Prime Minister's trip coincided with the 11th anniversary of Bahraini's uprising against the Al Khalifa rulers. Bahrain normalized ties with Israel last year under a U.S. brokered deal. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Bahraini activist and political analyst Saeed Shabi, who's joining us from the British capital, London. We also have writer and political commentator Ryan Dawson, who's joining us from Osaka. Let's start off with Mr. Shahabi. Mr. Shahabi, please talk to us about, first of all, the outrage that we're seeing right now from the Bahrainis due to the Israeli Prime Minister's visit there. They've made their voices heard. The opposition has been heard in solidarity with the Palestinians. What does this mean?
Thank you very much. This outrage has been there since the regime went ahead with the naturalization process with the Israeli regime. Last year or the year before, because the people have always been supportive of Palestine, the rights of the Palestinians. They have always been against the idea of occupation. No one in this world has the right to occupy the land of others. Occupation is evil. Even the United Nations until today considers the occupation of East Jerusalem and other places as invalid and illegal. So when the Prime Minister of Israel visited Bahrain yesterday and the day before, it was a cause for outrage among the people. It is just as if you are hitting the people in their hearts with this visit, because it runs against the grains of the feelings and the political inclination of the people and their moral standards. So it was so bad that the people just hurried to the streets in the last 48 hours, complaining, protesting, condemning the regime for its treacherous policy, especially that what is coming out of the visit is that the Israelis want to build a block against Iran. What for? What? Why in Bahrain? Why do we have to do? Why do we have to stand along Israel against Iran? What for? So this is a crime by the regime that will continue to enrage the people, and I'm sure it will have its reverberations continuing for the next months and years.
Ryan Dawson in Osaka, the Israeli Prime Minister's trip to Bahrain coincided with the 11th anniversary of the Bahraini's uprising against the Al Khalifa rulers. Talk to us about the significance of these demonstrations and protests that we're seeing right now.
We're seeing a backlash against Jared Kushner's Arab Accords. They made a giant deal out of making normalizing relations with Israel, and a lot of people in the press thought, oh, what a great thing. Well, it would be if that coincided with Israel changing its behaviors, which are the reason why there wasn't a normalization with Israel before, is because of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, its constant bombing of Damascus and bombing at different targets in Syria, its warmongering on Iran, and so forth. Israel didn't change any of its behaviors. So they maybe got the U.S. to give them a deal, bribe some of the leadership, but nothing changed on the ground. Israel's still annexing pieces of the West Bank and Palestine, still has a blockade on Gaza, still sends American-made F-15s in to bomb people in Syria, and is still ranting and raving about a non-existent nuclear bomb in Iran, which is ironic because Israel actually has nuclear weapons, which they made by stealing uranium from the United States, and yet the United States is there making deals. So, of course, the people, they see there was a defense pact made earlier this month. It is not in their interest to normalize relations with Israel. Why do they need to put any kind of economic sanctions or military agreements against Iran on behalf of Israel? That doesn't serve Bahrain at all. It's only in the service of Zionists, and it doesn't help the public's interest whatsoever. There may be some personal gains from the kings there, but that's all. It doesn't pass down. And they're trying to divide this between Sunni and Shia. It's ridiculous. On the one hand, they're supporting the Palestinians, which are majority Sunni, and they also don't war with Iran either, which are majority Shia. That's just the horizontalization that they usually go with to try to divide people, but they're seeing through this all. Israel is the problem. They should not have normalizations with the Zionist pariah state that routinely attacks their neighbors and colonizes the Palestinians.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Saeed Shaabi, Bahraini activist and political analyst, joining us from the British capital, London, and writer and political commentator Ryan Dawson speaking to us from Osaka. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Ottawa's police chief resigns amid criticism that he didn't do enough to stop prolonged anti-vax protests that have paralyzed the Canadian capital. The resignation comes as hundreds of trucks remain still parked outside the Canadian Parliament. And the Prime Minister's office, he says his personnel lack resources to peacefully disperse the protesters, with his defenders voicing fears that the use of force could stoke violence. On Monday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to end protests that have severely affected the country's economy. The demonstrations were started by Canadian truckers opposing an order demanding unvaccinated cross-border drivers to quarantine. The protests have turned into a rallying point for people opposing various policies of Trudeau's government. And Canada's dark colonial past once again comes to light with the discovery of dozens of more unmarked graves of Native children. An Indigenous community in Saskatchewan province has found 54 graves at two former residential schools. Saskatchewan Premier has offered sympathy with the Kisikus First Nation, saying they experience the same shock and despair as other First Nations across Canada. The new discovery brings to more than 1,300 the number of nameless graves found in Canada since last year. The country's authorities forcibly separated Indigenous children from their families during the 19th and 20th century to assimilate them into Canadian society. They were taken to residential schools run by the Catholic Church, where many were subjected to physical and psychological abuse. Church and the Canadian government have both apologized for the abuses. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg believes Canadian natives suffered many injustices on the process of colonization, including the way their children were treated. Take a listen.
Well, it's not only the children that were devastated. Their parents had their land stolen from them. So it was a theft and a genocide taking place all at once. And if you look back at the history, you see that there really was no intent to deal honestly with. There really was. There was some intent after the American Revolution. The natives were against the revolution because they knew that they would be wiped out and they trusted Britain more. So a lot of them came to Canada, were given land, and then the land was taken away again. So, I mean, at the very top, Queen Victoria was had nice relations with chiefs. But when you go down to the level of surveyors and the agents that were sent out, at the local level, they were pressured to give the settlers the land, all of the land. It was supposed to be kept, but 90% of it was taken away. So it's not just the children that were they were taken to be re-educated in order to become white, pseudo-white.
Welcome back. The inflation rate in the United Kingdom soared to its highest in 3 decades last month. Based on new official data, the annual consumer price inflation rose to 5.5% in January. The Office for National Statistics blames the rising energy prices for contributing to the hike. The inflation is intensifying the squeeze on households and may also force the Bank of England to further raise interest rates. Earlier this month, the bank predicted that inflation will peak over 7%. In April, business and consumer groups are warning that the rise in prices would harm living standards. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Siuto.
Chuman.
Yani.
Bazaar. Electrical cables are an essential part of our lives. Cables bring power to our homes and offices, countries and continents. They channel power and signals that make equipment hum and engines run, from oil rigs and broadcast studios to cars and trains, commercial buildings and factory floors. Cables keep information flowing, facilitating a non-stop stream of words and images that transcend speed and geographical limits.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of Bazaar with me, Sarah Dema.
In this episode, we're going to talk about the vast world of Iran's wire and cable productions. We wanted to see who makes these items and why they are so important to numerous industries across the country. Plus, we will check out some of this industry's contributions to the national economy. So get comfortable and let's start the show. To become more familiar with wire production, we visited Behtab Hadideh Alborz. It began its activity 5 years ago in the field of production and distribution of wires and cables. This company makes dozens of different types of wires and cables. Some are used in telecommunications, construction, electrical appliances, and automobile manufacturing. It also makes more complicated cables, such as coaxial cables. This type has an inner conductor surrounded by an insulating layer that is covered by conductive shielding. Currently, its production facilities have the capacity to make millions of meters of cables each month. Some 40 people work directly at this company, and 200 others are indirectly employed. It manufactures cables through a process of pulling either copper or aluminum cords. Advanced machines are used to stretch the metal conductors to the desired width. After this, depending on the use, the strands are either braided together or aligned and prepared for insulation covering. It is worth mentioning that this company has been producing wires and cables that were previously imported. Its productions have gained a significant share of the domestic market too. Such domestic productions have prevented large amounts of capital flight throughout the years. It might be interesting to know that 95% of raw materials needed to produce wires and cable can be domestically supplied. Because Iran is rich with natural resources, raw materials such as copper, aluminum, and petrochemical products are easily accessible to this industry. There is a small number of items that still need to be imported, such as sheath required for aluminum cables. One of the advantages of this company is its diverse product range. It also has the capability of producing special types of cables to meet specific customer requirements that may currently not exist in the country. Remarkably, a key competitive advantage of this company is its technical know-how and experience. This has helped it manufacture its production machines and equipment and localize this technology in the country. Using its own machines has other benefits too, such as being able to maintain and control the quality of their products. Quality issues are very important in the cable industry. This cable manufacturer follows stringent specifications for the quality and safety of its wires and cables. Products are checked in the quality control center for their performance as well as to match other standardizations necessary in the sector. It's important to have the highest quality because wires are meant to last for years and sometimes for decades. Therefore, this company uses the highest grade of raw material to produce its items. As part of its future goals, this company is adding new products to its portfolio, such as fiber optic cables. But that's not all. This manufacturer stands on the cusp of exporting its products and plans to expand its market reach to neighboring countries as well. Generally speaking, the country's wire and cable industry has witnessed exponential advancements over the years and has been developed in line with modern technical knowledge. Based on statistics from the industry, Iran produces more than what is needed for domestic consumption, so export-oriented production is an important aspect to keep this industry thriving. The National Wire and Cables Producers Association says over 80% of the country's needs are supplied domestically and productions compete in quality with global brands.
but the association says that exports are negligible compared to the large production outputs. Moreover, it estimates that Iran has the potential to sell at least $600 million worth of goods to neighboring countries annually. Yet the value of current exports is less than $100 million. So why is this? It's because this sector is only working at 30% of its entire capacity as it faces several obstacles for expansion and development. Industry participants say they can work at full production load if many of these challenges are removed. Increased production can also lead to more exports. Some of these challenges include the supply of machinery. More often than not, business owners are forced to go through multiple intermediaries to get the equipment they need. Doing so is time-consuming and adds to their costs. Other issues revolve around export barriers such as Iran's tariff system. Industry analysts say this system has inflated the end price of local products, sapping the country's competitiveness and exportability. Manufacturers say strict government regulations have also led to many businesses foregoing the path of exports altogether. The biggest consumers of wires and cables in the country are in the telecommunications sectors and electrical power industry. Electricity is the mother of all industries and is heavily dependent on wires and cables. Iran is capable of producing large amounts of electricity and fully supplies domestic needs. It exports electrical power too. This sector requires high voltage cables to be able to distribute electricity nationally and also internationally. According to the Electricity Industry Syndicate, domestic firms already produce high-voltage power cables and are ready to export their goods and services to international markets. Previously, these cables were imported, but domestic production has reduced imports by 20%. As the country develops its manufacturing industries, it also creates an enormous demand for electricity. The national power grid has been expanded by 60,000 kilometers in the last 4 years to meet growing requirements. Consequently, manufacturers had to set up production to supply wires and cables to the electrical power industry. We looked at some figures from the National Power Generation Transmission and Distribution Company. Data showed around 80% of the productions of wires and cables in Iran is supplied to the power industry alone. The remaining 20% are used in electrical appliance, automobile, and construction industries, among others. It can be said that wires and cables play an important role in the electrical and electronic industry. The increasing demand for power, light, and communication has kept demand high for wires and cables. This industry has so much potential, promising a bright future for further development and growth. Iran has many natural resources. Some are agricultural and some other are natural wonders enjoyed by tourists and locals alike. Still, other resources have to be extracted by mining. The mining industry is a very important component of the economic health of Iran, contributing billions in a given year. This modern industry is also heavily dependent on the discoveries and innovations made by knowledge-based companies. These firms are often pioneers of development, opening new horizons for industries while making industrial processes more efficient and less costly. One of the biggest capacities of Iran is its rich natural resources. Yes, we are talking about mines. They have brought tremendous profits while creating numerous jobs. This week, we will look at the mining industry and some of its related traits. We also want to uncover how this industry continues to expand and who is helping with its development. So let's start the show. There are thousands of mines in the country, But before extracting material and using it, samples first need to be taken to labs for analysis. We visited a knowledge-based company that specializes in testing mineral, soil, and water samples from mines. Zara Osmo was first established in 2006 and was created because of the lack of such services inside the country. Previously, analyzing samples from mines was outsourced abroad, but now, domestic sample analysis has never been as advanced as it is today. Using the latest technology, this company analyzes samples on an industrial scale with speed, precision, and high-quality testing. Most of the machines have been imported, as well as transferring the analysis know-how from other countries. It mainly provides services to the mining industry and some of its related trades. Samples are sent from mines nationwide to the advanced labs for titration. This is a common lab method of quantitative chemical analysis that determines the concentration of a substance. This massive facility has several departments, each dedicated to a specific activity and equipped with quality control processes. After crushing, samples are processed into liquids, either using high temperatures or alkaline melting. Then they are fed to high-tech machines for analysis. These machines provide a sample profile showing what materials and in what percentage are present. It's important to get a detailed survey of material in mining areas. The industry routinely collects samples to assist with decision-making. This data helps with exploration, resource estimation, grade control, or plant design and balances. Indigenizing sample analysis services have saved the country millions of dollars in outsourcing so far. This has also sped up many processes as the industry no longer has to wait months for analysis results. Typically, when a sale transaction of mining material is to take place, the sample profile must be presented. A profile shows some criteria, such as the purity and concentration of a material, revealing the quality of the batch. The results are also used to determine whether samples match up with international standardizations. This is important information used for exports and imports of mining material. This knowledge-based firm has labs in three other provinces, including the mining heartland of Kerman. Its test results are trusted by the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, the National Environmental Protection Agency, Mining Investment Insurance Corporation, and the National Copper Industries Corporation, among many others. This knowledge-based company also collaborates with research and academic institutions. Some 200 people are employed at these labs directly, and nearly 500 others work indirectly for this company. One of the competitive advantages is its rapid and reliable mineral testing. Plus, its highly developed quality control methods is what keeps them relevant in the market. Nearly 75% of all samples in the country are analyzed at these high-tech labs at affordable costs. Also, it has helped develop and expand Iranian mining sectors through its dependable lab studies. As part of its future vision, this knowledge-based company hopes to launch laboratories in neighboring regions. It also welcomes mineral samples from abroad for analysis. Iran is one of the most important mineral producers in the world. Here is an interesting fact that there are 60 billion tons of mineral reserves in the country. Roughly 40 billion tons of that total are proven reserves, meaning they are mineable. Iron, coppers, zinc, aluminum, and other minerals are also extracted from 6,000 mines in the country. The mining sector has made big strides in recent years, but it is still developing. Figures from the National Geological Survey and Mineral Exploration Agency show last year over 400 million tons of minerals were extracted. Aside from metal materials, the country is rich in construction materials too. Gravel, decorative stones, marble, sand, and cement make up over 60% of the country's mineral reserves. The government has been developing production capacities through various programs while expanding the sector's exploration projects to this end. One of these plans is to revive idle mines. Out of 10,000 mines in the country, around 4,000 of them are idle. It's noteworthy, over the last 2 years, some 500 small-scale idle mines have been brought back to life. That's based on the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization. One of the benefits of the ongoing revival plan has been the rise in nationwide employment. Presently, well over 100,000 miners are at work in the sector. You might find it interesting to know that Iran holds the largest zinc reserves. Plus, it has the 9th largest copper reserves and the 10th largest iron ore and uranium reserves. With 7% of global mineral reserves, the export of mineral products generates millions in foreign revenue annually. But export figures could be much higher if the raw material is developed further with added value. Numerous industries use raw materials provided by the mining sector. In the first half of 2020 alone, Iran was credited for producing 50% of the world's sponge iron. The majority of iron is used in the domestic steel industry. Last year, the World Steel Association ranked Iran as the 10th largest steel maker in the world. Figures showed that last year, over 55 million tons of mineral products were exported. The value of these exports was nearly $8 billion. The organization estimates that this year's export values will be much higher.
We all know what it feels like to be sick. You feel sluggish, fatigued, or lose your appetite, and perhaps become more sensitive to pain and cold. Many times, people can treat themselves at home with self-care and homemade remedies. Other times, a trip to the doctor does the trick. But even then, some ailments require more advanced interventions for diagnosis and therapies provided by hospitals. This is where medical devices come in handy. The health sector is mainly dependent on the accuracy and zero failure of advanced medical technology to get the job done.
All right, everyone, it's time to take a break as I'm gonna take you out on the field to a company, but I won't tell you any further. Let's go check it out. In a world grappling with coronavirus, a significant number of health-related companies have been looking for a solution to contain the spread of the virus. With the development of various testing methods, there has been a huge spike in demand for the virus sampling kits, and especially the sampling swabs.
God, I'm just so very tired of wearing masks. But what can I say? Ever since the pandemic took the world by storm, our life has changed in an unpredictable way. One of the prominent changes is the development of sampling technology to meet the evolving need of COVID-19 testing. Today, we came to Damahi Biotechnology Company to see how the sampling swabs that we see everywhere are produced. So don't go anywhere, stay with me.
At the start of the outbreak, most of the sampling swabs were imported into the country and the domestic supply chain had been inconsistent. For this reason, this Iranian company in biotechnology decided to take steps towards promoting local sampling swabs on a large scale. When it comes to production, the swabs are produced in two different forms: oral swabs and nasal swabs. Anyway, let's take a look at the production line.
All right, the production process of the sampling swabs begins in this unit. At this stage, after the plastic handles are imported into this factory, they go through the swab flocking machine to form the header. Actually, when I look at it, it kind of looks like the ear cleaning swabs that we use on a day-to-day basis. But in fact, they are completely different. These headers are actually made of fibers, so it's totally something else. When the swabs are produced, they get to this stage for quality control and cleaning before they get to the packing hall. And finally, they pass through the sealer machine for pressing. But I should mention that the swabs are not finalized at this stage. They have to go through the sterilization process, and by the end of the day, the sterilized swabs are transported to different laboratories all across the country.
In case you wonder about the head of the swab, unlike how we thought earlier that it looks like the ear-cleaning swab, the foam-headed material eliminates the possibility of adhesive residue contamination. So by the end, the sterilized sampling swabs are distributed for field or home testing to meet the growing need of the country.
Even though it looks very simple, the production procedure of the sampling swabs is very complicated. Thanks to the development of such diagnostic tools, the world has managed to curb the pandemic in numerous ways. I've been Sarah Adema. I'll see you in the next edition. And until then, stay safe and bye-bye. We are almost out of time for this episode, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in this industry and its related trades. The wire and cable industry get most of its raw material from the mining sector, and copper productions have gone through the roof recently.
Iran is self-sufficient in the production of copper cathode that is used to make wires. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, domestic production of copper cathode rose by 9% last year. As reported, nearly 200,000 tons of cathode were produced in 2021. That's close to the government goal, which aims to increase cathode output to roughly 230,000 tons in the coming years. Copper and aluminum are frequently used in wires because of their low resistance and excellent conductivity. Plus, these materials are relatively resistant to corrosion, which allows for various types of applications.
Home appliance manufacturing was up nearly 10% last year, despite several challenges and restrictions on the growth of the sector.
The Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade says home appliance manufacturing stood at 15 million sets last year. This registered a 78% increase in production compared to the year before. Ministry officials say the home appliance industry's infrastructure and capacities have developed in leaps and bounds over the last 5 years. Owing to this, the country is projected to become a major exporter of such products in the coming years. The government has increased support for domestic production to neutralize the impacts of the U.S. sanctions and diversify the economy away from oil revenues. The home appliance sector has been one of the pioneers in this regard as it witnesses significant progress.
Dozens of electricity projects have been launched this year in Yazd province to bring areas in this region online with the power grid.
Nearly 130 projects worth $4 million started in Yazd province. The developments fall into four categories. These include network construction, electricity supply to rural areas, repairing networks, and improving lighting for cities and villages. Yazd Electricity Distribution Company estimates over 100,000 meters of low and medium voltage pressure cables need to be installed for these projects. According to the distributor, the province has some 73,000 electricity subscribers, but almost 75% of power is used by industries.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for tuning in and see you next time on another edition of Bazaar.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us. The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're on chapter 3 of the social system of Islam, which is part 3 as well. And this particular topic is discussing the Islamic form, the Islamic system of building a municipality. How should a city be run from the Islamic perspective? It's a very important issue because it discusses a variety of things, from the Islamic approach to how to have a Muslim or Islamic image as far as a city is concerned. And although we've discussed a lot of social elements to how we need to interact with other citizens in a city, we haven't discussed what the basis of this city should look like from an Islamic perspective. And Islam does have a lot to say when it comes to building, when it comes to the dividing of, for example, responsibilities and things like that, what the public space should be, what the private dominion should be. A lot of these other very, very interesting things to do with cultural centers, religious centers, educational facilities, hygiene, public cleanliness, how a house should be divided and things like that. So it is indeed an interesting topic to look into, and there's a lot that all of us can benefit from. We know that Baytul Mal is spent on the public funds, on the making sure that people are comfortable living in that particular sense, and at the same time remembering that if a person does increase in the spending or steal maybe even from public funds, then of course they will have a very, very severe punishment on Judgment Day. That's based on the Ahadith. Now, one example of what we can see as public funds, we mentioned, is building of schools, building of hospitals, building of public facilities, remembering that, you know, you're going to need to make sure that all of these things are facilitated for the people. Building of wells as well, you know, it's also something emphasized very much on Ahadith. And of course, one of the applications of public service is sadaqah, charity giving, donation, almsgiving. And as Muslims, alhamdulillah, we all know how much Islam emphasizes on sadaqah and on charity giving. And there's a special emphasis here given by Islam on charity giving because it needs to manage the affairs of the underprivileged, of the poor, of those who are not fortunate enough to be able, for example, to work or to have sustainability in their work or to have any kind of sustenance that they are regularly able to live off of. And therefore, financial help is something very, very important. Of course, the spiritual help is always going, the moral help is always going to be there as well, you know, but at the end of the day, they need these poor people, these destitutes, they need food on the table, they need medication, they need shelter. There are a variety, they need clothes, they need a variety of things, you know, and sadaqah deals with that. Which is exactly why the most recommended mustahab thing for a person to do on a regular basis is pay sadaqah. If you do this, pay sadaqah. If you do that, pay sadaqah. If you go there, pay sadaqah. الصدقة تدفع البلاء. صدقة repels any kind of evil misfortune that might come a person's way. And that's why sadaqah is very, very valuable from the Islamic perspective of social interaction with those who are underprivileged. And this is why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, خَيْرُ مَالِ الْمَرْءِ, the best money of a person, the best form of financial gains of a person, ذَخَائِرُهُ الصَّدَقَةِ, is what he or she saves up as charity giving, as sadaqah.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book مفاتيح الحیات, The Keys of Life. This book, مفاتيح, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتی الجنان است چه فرم دماغی و سواب داره فرم روزون
است. One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرم درخکاری اینجا کم سواب داره. دعا هم داره, سواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که رو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دقل ثواب داره.
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون اینم هم امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another hadith says about when we should give sadaqah. Obviously, you should be giving sadaqah any time that you are able to. And sadaqah, when you're giving charity, doesn't necessarily need to be big sums of money. It can be coins if you want to. It's the niyyah, it's the intention that is very important. You know, when you are paying sadaqah and you know that paying sadaqah is going to repel evil, repel misfortune, repel all these other things, you also know that you're going to be helping someone. So it's a win-win basis. Yes, it's very hard to get money. It's very hard to earn money. But at the same time, how are you showing your gratitude to God? How are you expressing your solidarity with those unfortunate people who are around you? You know, how are you able to go against your nafs and combat your nafs by suppressing your dunyawi desires because of your love for money? The best way is to give it away. Do you need to give all of it away? No. The Quran says, don't close your hand into a fist and lock it to your neck, nor should you open it out all the way. And that is in reference to don't be a stingy, greedy person. Also, don't be someone who isn't able to manage your finances in a correct way and think that, well, I'm just going to give it all away. No, be moderate. Have that balance. You know, you earn an income of this much money, 5% of it, 2% of it, whatever it may be, give it to mustahab sadaqah, mustahab charity. Perfect. You know, it doesn't need to be 50%. You could probably be giving 1%, but with pure intention, and it will be accepted in the hands, in the eyes of God, and also reach someone who's going to help live off of it. That's the beautiful thing about sadaqah. So you should be giving sadaqah whenever you're able to. But here, just a few cases in where Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam have mentioned when sadaqah is best to be given. One hadith from Imam Ali where he says to his son Imam Hassan, make sure that whenever you have food, you pay sadaqah. Or from that food, you give out as charity. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahireen.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.